I have a brother who is a very, very good singer. Now I have a choice. I can either be jealous and resent his talent, or I can say, hey, he's my brother. Who was it who said, if a Jew doesn't feel guilty, he blames himself. How do you make yourself happy? How can you be commanded to be happy? Tomorrow, you have to be happy. What do you want me to do? What do you want me to do? So you can say, you know, fake it till you make it. Once you hear this, all questions fall away. You're asking? This conversation is over.
Hi, I'm Rivka.
And I'm Ida.
Welcome to From the Inside Out podcast.
Now a global community that keeps growing every day thanks to each and every one of you. Here's where you'll find insights from some of our world's greatest thinkers, leaders, and our everyday heroes. Our main goal is to bring you inspiration that you will turn into action. We're very excited about this episode. What do you think, Rivka? What was your...
With Rabbi Friedman, it's always unexpected. Like, we had this plan of where we wanted the episode to go, but the episode went kind of to a different place. I have a lot of clarity. I just feel at peace after speaking to Rabbi Friedman. And then also not to be scared of sharing the truth.
Right.
Yeah, not to be scared of sharing the truth, that that's going to come across as arrogant or misleading, but that truth is truth. And to know that truth is really from Hashem. And so you're not really making it all about you. You're sharing godliness.
Yeah, truth is liberating. And the more you speak the truth, the more you say what you believe to be true, the easier life gets and the more empowered you're going to feel.
The change that happens within you and the same way with enthusiasm, that's going to end up changing things around you.
Yeah, confidence and truth.
And that's how we can win the war.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks for being here and let the conversation begin.
From the inside out.
Welcome, Rabbi Friedman. Welcome back to our podcast. We had you once on Zoom. I think it was towards the end of COVID, was it? So that's why we have you live, which is very exciting. And if you ever want to go back to that episode, it's amazing. It is called Why We Are Here?
I think so, yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
We actually also had you on a panel with Rabbi Chase Taub and Rabbi Simon Jacobson, which was amazing as well. So if you want to go back and listen to that. And today we are here to discuss with you how to win a war. This is the book that Rabbi Friedman just came out with, To Win a War. We wanted to discuss how to win a war the Jewish way in Israel, and also how to win the war within ourselves and our own lives and in the wars that we battle. Well, we wanted to open up with saying that we spent some time together a couple of weeks ago where we were all brought out together, and it was an honor to be with you, which perhaps we can get into as well.
Is that part of the war?
It's part of the war. It all started there. And we wanted to know your impressions. We just released an episode with Sapir Cohen, who was a hostage in Gaza, and we were so inspired by her. She was brought out to Scottsdale, Arizona as well by Beth Tefillah, and we wanted to know what your takeaways were. What was your impression?
I was completely humbled by the whole thing. 55 days a hostage, and she carries herself with such dignity and such simplicity. Awesome. We feel like children compared to her. The things we complain about, the things we worry about, very humbling.
It is humbling. It gives you hope for humanity.
Makes me feel like, why does life have to get difficult for people to wake up and start appreciating things that matter?
Well, that's the Lubavitch slogan of L'chatchila Dibur. Why do you have to wait for an emergency to show how strong you are? Without the emergency, you're just as strong. So L'chatchila, why do you have to wait for the...
Now, the interesting thing is, though, is that the purpose of the world is to bring light to the darkness. So I guess it makes sense that it would take a dark time for us to reveal the light within us.
In that sense, since creation, the world has been dark. You don't need any more of an emergency than that.
That's true. So we have the darkness.
Right. So anyone who believes in repairing the world, in Tikkun Olam, has declared war.
Right.
If the status quo is not acceptable and something has to change, that's war. That's the war that is necessary and justified and noble. When it deteriorates to bombs and bullets, it's not so nice. But war as a subject, as an idea, the whole idea of creation is remove the negative, bring in the positive. That's war. So we wake up in the morning and we're at war. Unless you think this is as good as it gets and you're fine with it. And that's not acceptable.
So war doesn't have to be a negative term.
No, war is a definition of life. Definition of growth, accomplishment. If you say it's got to be better than this, you've declared war.
That gives us permission to battle whatever weaknesses and issues that we have, because that's maybe where the war needs to be fought for someone who didn't experience something at the level of, you know, what Sapir did.
Yeah, so a person who says, everything's fine, just let's all just get along and live and let live. You gave up the battle. That's a failure.
The question is, when to pause? When is that time to say, just live and let live?
Never.
Well, it could be, sometimes if someone's done something hurtful to you and you feel like maybe that wouldn't be a time to speak up and just let go and let live.
All right, so that's your strategy. You're fighting the war. You haven't given in. So it's not really a pause. It's a strategy. Sometimes even retreat is part of the strategy. But you don't quit.
So in this book, I didn't see a lot of retreat. There wasn't really a retreat option to win a war. What would you say? How would, in a nutshell, maybe you can share with us, how can we win the war in Israel today?
Well, I think what's going on demonstrates so convincingly that there really is no wisdom out there without the Torah. There's just no wisdom. It's embarrassing to consider what is suggested and what is considered wisdom, morality, strategy for war. It's so embarrassing. Like, for example, this noble idea of proportionate response. Proportionate response is so childish. Oh, you hit me twice, I only hit you once. Yeah, that's not fair. That is so childish. If you really had proportionate response in a war, the war would never end.
Right.
How do you win a war? You do more than your enemy. If you do exactly what your enemy does, it's so embarrassingly inane. What does Torah say? And it's so obviously true and brilliant and moral. It's immoral to say, respond proportionately. Where's the morality in that? Hit me, I'll hit you. Hit me, I'll hit you. Where's the morality? Proportionate means not proportionate to what the enemy did. Proportionate means proportionate to the pursuit of peace. What does it take to bring peace? Because if you're not fighting a war in order to bring peace, then you're just a warmonger and there's no hope for you. The reason for fighting a war is to bring peace. If I can bring peace by killing one person, then I'm not allowed to kill two. That makes so much sense and it's so moral. Why are you killing two people when you can have peace after killing one? If killing one person will not bring peace, then you can't settle for that. So here's how immoral this whole thing is. You start a war, two sides, there's fighting, there's, right? And it reaches a number that makes you uncomfortable. Oh, we've killed 20,000. Oh, that's a lot. Okay, we got to stop now. What happens if you stop now?
You're not bringing peace.
20,000 people died for nothing. You're so worried about a 20,000? No, you're not. You're willing to throw them under the bus after they're no longer alive and say, okay, we wasted 20,000, but we shouldn't waste 30,000. You wasted? This is moral? So there are two things. If by killing one person you can end the war and have peace, then don't kill two. But if it takes 30,000 to end the war and you've killed 20,000, it would be immoral to stop. Because until you've reached peace, people have died for nothing. So proportionate means not proportionate to how many times you hit me. That's so childish. That's like kids arguing in a schoolyard.
Tit for tat.
Yeah, it's right. So embarrassingly. But the objective to obtain peace, if that is your guiding light, then yes, you will behave proportionately, proportionate to the peace. It makes so much sense. It is so moral. That's godly wisdom. Another example is killing civilians. Civilians, there are too many civilians. This was never a conversation in any war in history. Now, who's a civilian?
Now it's a big conversation. Yeah, what is a civilian? How would you define a civilian?
Yes. How do you define civilian? If he's not wearing a uniform, he's civilian?
Now, how do you define an innocent civilian?
Right.
Because Sapir was saying that when she was taken in, she had civilians hitting her, knocking her, trying to kill her.
Right. So the fact that they're not wearing a uniform doesn't mean they're civilians. For example, the guy doesn't have a uniform. He works in a factory that makes bullets. Is he a civilian? No, he's part of the war machine. What if he doesn't make bullets? He makes boots for the soldiers. He's part of the war machine. So the guy who makes bullets is not a civilian. The guy who makes boots is not a civilian. The woman who makes soldiers, oh, she's a civilian. Does that make any sense?
You mean the mother who makes soldiers?
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
So really, what is a civilian? And are you supposed to protect a civilian? Is there such a principle anywhere in the world before the Geneva Convention? A civilian is someone who surrenders. Otherwise, how do you know he's a civilian? If he hands you the gun and says, I give up, I'm yours, don't kill him. It would be wrong to kill him because he is not a threat. He is non-combatant. He's surrendered. But if you go into a village, like Jenin, for example, because there's terrorism coming out of, you have to identify the civilian. Among all your duties as a soldier, one of your duties is to identify the civilian. First of all, it's senseless. And secondly, it's immoral. You're asking every soldier to risk his life while he's trying to figure out who is the civilian. There's no morality there. It's sheer insanity. It's suicide. A civilian has to identify himself. It is not my job to identify your civilian.
Have any civilians identified themselves?
those who surrendered. Just recently, they took 80 prisoners because they put down their guns and surrendered. Morality without Torah does not exist. It's become very, very clear. So Israel now has to export morality because Ki Metzia in Teitze Torah. The world desperately needs Israel to be the moral leader. And instead, Israel follows the dictates of the Geneva Conference and the UN. That is so immoral. There is no morality out there. Torah is the only hope left. And what about hostages?
Yeah.
Isn't it amazing? Whenever two countries go to war with each other, Arab countries, Muslim countries, they never take hostages. Never. Why? Because what would be the point? Nobody cares. You also never hear them complain about human shields. When Arabs are fighting with Arabs or Muslims are fighting with Muslims, they never use human shields. Why? Because nobody would care. We keep telling them, we will protect your civilians. Well, you've suggested it. They're following your suggestion. They use civilians as a shield. No one else does that, so everybody else's civilians are safe. And the same with hostages. They don't take hostages because the enemy won't do anything to get their hostages back. So what's the point? When you say we will do anything to get our hostages back, what are you doing? You're literally encouraging, suggesting, take a hostage. So yes, there are hostages and it's a horrible thing. But 200 hostages is bad enough. The whole country became a hostage now? That's not acceptable. Can't do that. The army has to do what it has to do without thought of the hostages.
That would be considered a drastic statement.
So somebody suggested early on in the war, cut off all water, all electricity. What are they going to do? Kill the hostages? They're gonna have to surrender because they're dying from hunger. If you return the hostages, we won't starve you out. Nobody gets hurt. Why didn't they do that?
What does the Torah have to say about saving a life, like pikuach nefesh? You have these hostages who are in Gaza, and we know that they're there. So without thought of the hostages means that Israel would intentionally be killing their own innocent people. What are the rules of war when it comes to that? According to the Torah, the Torah would support not trying to save the hostage for the purpose of the greater.
Well, if you can save the hostages, of course. But having thousands of soldiers die because you're concerned about the hostages, what kind of morality is that?
I don't know if it was because of concern of the hostages. It was because they were more concerned about the civilians.
It's a double whammy.
Yeah.
We got to be careful because of civilians, and we have to be careful because of hostages, which means we can't fight the war. That's why it's over 150 days. It shouldn't be that way. The bottom line is we suffer from a gullus mentality. We have been abused. We have been victimized for 2,000 years, and it shows. We are not confident. We don't have the conviction that it takes to really fight a war.
Is that why you wrote the book? What were you trying to address specifically in doing this project?
The reason for the book is Jews all over the world who are up naturally pro-Israel, of course, but they feel a little guilty. I mean, yeah, we are killing a lot of civilians. And so we kind of start to hesitate. And yes, it's disproportionate. And yeah, what about the hostages? So, you know, rah, 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 Israel, go, go. But they're going to hate us. We're doing something wrong. That's got to go. So the book is really not for Israel. The book is for Jews in the world who for the last 70 years have been pro-Israel, of course. They'll do anything for Israel. But someplace in the back of their mind, they're feeling a little guilty. They listen to the marchers and the protesters, and there's a little, maybe we are to blame. We're so good at that. We've been practicing that for 2,000 years.
Yeah, why is that? Why do Jews feel guilty?
We have a terrible inferiority complex.
Yeah, what is that about? We're the chosen people, yet we feel guilty.
Yeah. It makes us feel even more guilty.
Because we're chosen.
Yeah. Oh, and you're the chosen people, huh? Yeah, everything makes us feel guilty. Who was it who said, if a Jew doesn't feel guilty, he blames himself.
But we're also good at blaming other people.
Yeah, but that doesn't hurt.
Right. So how would you tell a Jew to get over his guilt? To read the book.
And many other books.
Right.
But what we represent, the morality that we bring to the world, the purpose of life, the view of the future of the planet, we got it right. I don't see anybody else who does. So we must be the teachers, not the students. It's an old story. We are the light to the nations. That means teaching. So if you don't believe in your own values and your own principles and your own Torah, you're not going to win. You have to be absolutely confident. Torah is the truth. We have the truth. We preserved it with great cost. We refuse to compromise it. We refuse to edit it or to try to improve on it. We have preserved the Torah. And now, after every experiment in the world has been tried, the conclusion, the evidence, is that the Torah is exactly what we need. You can't improve on it. There is nothing wrong with it. It's exactly what God wants. Why are we hesitating? So one of the things that we need to do is stop discussing meaningless ideas. Like, for example, have you read about Darwin's theory that we are descendants of monkeys or apes? Would you like to discuss this? The answer is no. It's too embarrassing. You think we're descendants of apes? We're not going to have a conversation about that. You're not going to drag me into this idiocy. It's absolutely idiotic. Oh, no, it's a theory. Do me a favor. Enough. Stop it. You don't know that we are the chosen people? Then we can't have a conversation. And I'm not going to sit here debating what the world has known for thousands of years. Are the Jews the chosen people? Well, no. Like the presidents of the universities? Is it immoral to massacre babies? And we'll discuss it. No, we're not going to discuss it. This conversation is over. Enough. Enough catering to the insanity of the world. Is Jerusalem the capital of Israel? You're asking? This conversation is over. No more degrading yourself by engaging in conversations that should never happen.
What about trying, so listen, we know this to be true, and then we have the other side who believes that their stance is the truth. Like, how do you convince the other side that what they're thinking or experiencing is a projection of their own inner reality, let's say, and that what we're saying is truth? How do we have, we still have to kind of have these conversations.
There was a time when there were huge debates about idolatry. This God and that God, and nobody has that conversation anymore. Somebody comes and says, you think the sun may be God? Okay, I'm leaving the room. Never mind the conversation. It's right? We have our current idiotic ideas that don't deserve conversation. So if you want to know about God, great. You have questions about why do bad things happen to good people? Good. This is an intelligent conversation. Are we descendants of monkeys? Yeah. Go home and celebrate your ancestors. Come on. This is enough with this ridiculous. And the same thing with, but how many civilians are you killing? You should not be involved in this conversation. You don't know what a civilian is. You don't know morality if you tripped on it. You're making everything worse. So just go home. Go back to kindergarten. Read a book or something. But don't march in the streets protesting things you have no idea what you're saying.
There have also been people that were more to the left that have now changed their tune and gone toward the right.
Not because of religion.
Yeah, not because of religion, because they saw something was not right.
Yes.
So what I'm saying is that you can actually see that people can change their minds. I'm saying it is good to engage because people do change their minds.
I don't think they change their minds because of an argument.
Right. So they change their minds because...
of the facts.
Of the facts.
On the other hand, all those people marching, hundreds, thousands, everywhere in the world, for hours, don't they have anything they need to do for themselves? Like go home and make dinner or something?
Well,
you work for a living. What are you doing?
But do they believe that that's what I wanted. Do they believe that it's truth? Do they believe that they're doing is, like, have they convinced themselves that that is true?
Yes, and that is so sad. Not only that it's true, they convince themselves that they are doing a moral thing by protesting and marching and shouting and screaming. Is it really moral? They have no idea. In fact, they don't even know what they're protesting.
Right.
From the river to the sea. Which river? I don't know. Which sea?
Yeah, when you ask any of them the question, they don't know anything.
Nothing.
Yeah,
but so what are they doing?
We don't know.
So you can say, ooh, all that hatred. It's not hatred. It's sheer stupidity motivated by the desire to be moral. And that there's something impressive about this.
It's motivated by the desire to be moral? Do you think anti-Semitism is motivated
by... It's not anti-Semitism.
But there is anti-Semitism.
Oh.
Yeah. So you're not just talking about people who are just marching the streets and they don't know what they're doing. But there's that, and there's also some of those people are anti-Semites.
They don't even know what a Semite is.
You mean the anti-Semite doesn't know what a Semite is?
Right. They don't know.
Right, so you were saying that they have this desire to be moral. Don't you think some anti-Semites have innate hatred?
But they think they're being moral.
Right, they think they're being
moral. Also, when they see a lot of people, a crowd, it's feeling a certain way, people tend to go with the crowd. It's like this quote that we talked about in a couple episodes ago about truth. It's like truth doesn't become more true because everybody agrees with it. And it doesn't become less true if everyone disagrees with it. It's sort of like people just want to be a part of something. And like Rabbi Friedman said, a lot of them are uneducated, but they just feel like, oh, if everyone believes it, then naturally I should believe it too. That's one of the struggles that we have, is we're very much on the isolated end.
So the belief is paper thin. There's no depth to it at all. They're not sure what they're believing. They're not sure that they believe, but they want to be involved in something meaningful.
Right.
And going home and making supper is not meaningful. There's something very positive about that, which means that in a moment they can flip. They don't care what the cause is. They just want to have a cause.
Jordan Peterson said that when he used to get a lot of protests when he spoke at universities, I think in Canada, he said that to resolve that, he just scheduled his talks at 8 a.m. when they're all still sleeping.
Oh, that's hysterical.
Yeah, yeah. It's like they care, but they don't really care.
It's not really their issue.
Right.
But the fact that they're putting aside personal benefit or personal and marching to an issue, there's a desperation in the world. Everyone wants to be involved in something meaningful. They just don't know what's meaningful.
Right. And then you would think that it would be good to engage, but it doesn't seem to work.
To engage in a debate now?
No.
But to tell the truth? Sure.
So I wanted to shift a little bit because we did something a little different this time, in that we invited questions from our listeners and our audience. And I think that there's one that somewhat relates to this idea of Hashem and truth and other ways of achieving it. So like morality, other ways of achieving it. So somebody was asking about, specifically about other ways of connecting to a spiritual source, to God. And they were asking specifically about yoga and chanting vibrational sounds. But I feel like the question can be opened up even more, in that people often look for connection to God through other means. How do you feel about that? What's your stance on that? What's the Torah's view on you're trying to achieve that, you know, that feeling or that connection to Hashem, but it's not necessarily happening through the direct source, aka Torah and, you know, whichever, the Jewish way. How do you feel about making a little detour with the hope of getting there?
There is some validity to it. If I refine myself, if I heighten my awareness, if I become more sensitized to godliness, will I understand God better? Yeah, of course. It is the slow, torturous path. God said, let me do you a favor. Meet me at Mount Sinai, and I will tell you. You don't have to guess, and you don't have to come up to heaven. I'll come down to earth, and I will tell you. And then you will know for sure, because you heard it from me. So instead of trying to become like me in order to understand me, I'll come down and talk your language and be more like you so that you'll understand me.
Right. So it's essentially the long, short way. Is that what it's called? The long, short way. You can get there much faster, but you're choosing to take a more arduous path.
And no guarantees of success. You'll meditate, you'll refine yourself, you'll fast, and maybe some spirit of holiness will, maybe not. It's been tried for thousands of years. It goes nowhere. The Torah is God's gift. Don't come to heaven looking for me. I'll come down to earth and make myself known.
So how do
we? Here's another. Really, I think once you hear this, all questions fall away. The Torah says Avraham and Sarah didn't have children for many years. Sarah suggested that Avram have a child with her maid, Hagar. She has a child with the maid. The maid becomes a concubine. And Yishmael is born. Sarah says to Avraham, send them away. Because Yishmael, being Avraham's son, thinks that he inherits Avraham, that he is the heir. No good. Send them away. The words, the exact words are, Sarah said, the son of the maid will not inherit together with my son Yitzchak. That's where the war began. The issue on the table right now is, who inherits Israel? We now know, because of all the facts of history, you cannot possess Israel through war or through purchase or through a gift. No matter how many times you conquer it, it stays Israel. The Romans had it, it was Israel. Babylonians had it, it was Israel. Persians had it, it was Israel. Turks had it, it was Israel. It will never become anything but Israel because this tiny little piece of land is an inheritance. If you inherit it, it's yours. Otherwise, it will never be. So the rest of the world has given up on conquering Israel. The descendants of Esav are not trying to conquer Israel anymore. The Crusades are over. Because we know you either inherit it or you will never own it. The only war left are those who are the followers of Yishmael, who claim that it is theirs by inheritance. And nobody listens. If we would just listen to what the Muslim believes, he believes that he is a descendant of Yishmael, older son of Avraham. Israel is an inheritance, and they inherit. This explains everything. Why have we made no progress whatsoever in 70 years?
You're saying because they believe they have the inheritance, and we believe we have the inheritance.
But we don't say that. This is the joke of the whole. They believe that it is theirs by inheritance.
Right.
And we say, oh, but we're the only democracy in the Middle East. And they look at us like, did you not hear what I said?
Right, so we're not saying the actual truth of what's in the Torah, that we've inherited it.
In other words, we're not taking their claim seriously. Fine, you inherit, but we're a democracy. You're not taking them seriously. But it is the crux of the entire problem. Why haven't we made any progress? Because you're not responding to their claim. We have a right to defend ourselves. Not in my country. It's my country. It's my land. Well, how about if we give you Gaza? You give me? What a chutzpah. It's my land. Well, then we're going to have to beat you up and destroy you. Yeah, you can beat me up. It's still my land. Everything makes... Why is a Jewish baby a threat to them? Jewish babies were never a threat to Christians. But a baby is a threat to... Why? If there was one Jewish baby alive in the world, he inherits the whole land. That's what we're dealing with. So what is our response? We have a right to defend ourselves. Why are you avoiding the issue? So to the Arab, that sounds like you know you're wrong, and you have nothing to say about the issue, So get out. You're practically admitting that it's our country. Because I keep saying, it's my country, and you don't know, you don't answer. So what do we need to say? We need to say the Torah already solved or resolved this question. Yes, Yishmael is the older son, but he is not the heir. Sarah said he does not inherit. Avraham said, maybe. So God said,
listen to Sarah.
Confirmed what we need to say very clearly. Yishmael is not the heir. So even if you were descendants of Yishmael, you would not inherit. But you're not descendants of Yishmael. There is not a single Muslim who can trace his lineage to Yishmael. Not one.
Where do they trace their lineage to?
They're all intermarried. They're not Semites.
So you're saying they're not descendants of Yishmael?
They're not biological descendants.
And what about Esav?
I don't know anybody.
You mean Yitzchak? Do you mean Yitzchak with the Jew? Meaning like...
No, you're saying that the Arabs right now are not descendants of Ishmael?
No.
Who are they descendants of?
They're intermarried.
Uh-huh.
Could they make the same argument about Jews?
Ah, that's why when they really get serious about this issue and they know that the Jews are the heirs, they say you're not really Jewish. And that argument needs to happen.
Why?
The only thing that Rebbe ever responded to in all the complaints and accusations in the UN, Israel is the aggressor and you started the war and it's all your fault and your occupiers, Rebbe never responded. One time, a Saudi Arabian representative said, you're not Jewish. You're not Jews, you're just Europeans. The Rebbe took that very seriously and responded at a Fabrenge for 40 minutes.
And said?
And said, of course we are the children of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Because that is the crux of the problem. Now, to their credit, they do believe in God like Avraham. They never had statues, idols. That's to their credit. They are circumcised.
Yishmael was.
Yishmael was, and so are they. So they are, let's say, religious disciples of Avraham, but they are disciples don't inherit. But because they really do believe in God, and they really are religious, if you say to them, Torah says you don't inherit. They'll listen.
Right, but they don't go by the Torah. They go by...
Again, because they think the Torah is not what the original whatever.
Right, so they won't necessarily listen because they don't go by the Torah.
So what you need to do is present a confident, factual position. Torah is Torah. We are the Jews. Sorry.
Right.
We've never done that.
We haven't done that.
Never.
We've never done it?
No.
Not in history? Not at all?
So I'm saying if we all do that, that's all fine and good, but the government has to actually do it.
The Israeli government?
Yes.
And we can influence the Israeli government to have a little more confidence in our Jewish reality rather than political reality. And that has been the Rebbe's position all along. Whether Israel is a political reality, who cares? And by the way, political reality is an oxymoron. If it's political, it's not reality. And right. If it's reality, it's not political. But that we are Jews, that we are descendants of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, that's absolutely true. And at a great cost, by the way. We refused to assimilate when it was very easy to do. And now that we have successfully survived intact, we're afraid to say it? That's crazy. And by the way, the world knows. It's not like we have to convince them. There was a protest on one of the campuses that was very nasty, pro-Hamas, whatever, and the Jewish students were just speechless. They didn't know what to do, terrified. Until one professor got up and objected and said what needed to be said. The police came and arrested him for his own safety. That's how bad it was. The next day he comes to teach his class. And he is famous on the campus as the atheist Jewish professor. He made sure that everybody knew that he was an atheist. He comes to class in the morning and a student approaches him and gives him a bouquet of flowers. He says, "What is this?" She says, "I was so proud of what you did yesterday when you got up there." And he says, "You're Jewish?" She didn't look Jewish. He says, "You're Jewish?" She says, "No." He says, "So why are you?" She says, "It was so comforting, reassuring, to see the chosen people behaving chosen." He says, "Oh, you know I don't believe that."
Oh, gosh.
She said, "Whether you believe it or not, we know it's true. We don't really even have to convince them. We just have to start acting like we also know."
Right.
So if we just show a little confidence, the world would be so comfortable with Jews. Because they think we're chosen and we act like we're not. That messes everybody up. They know we're chosen and we act chosen. The world is good.
Do you think we mistaken confidence for arrogance? Meaning if we project confidence,
we'll come across as arrogant.
Right, correct, right.
Not necessary. See, it's not like we chose. We were chosen. What do you want me to do? We're chosen. What am I supposed to do? Nobody asked me. God chose us. Where's the arrogance?
Right. Sometimes when you're chosen, that can cause jealousy.
Yes, it has. For 2,000, 3,000 years, it has caused jealousy.
So that's the problem. Then people are jealous. It's a big problem when people are jealous. What do you do with that?
Yeah. So I have a very good analogy. Let's say Albert Einstein has a brother who is no Einstein. He's jealous. Why is everyone always talking about Albert? But imagine that this guy, his brother, has a mathematical question that he can't resolve. Should he ask his brother?
It would be
totally idiotic for him not to. So what is he doing? He says, "Oh, you know, if you have a mathematical dilemma or whatever, puzzle, my brother, he's good." So instead of being jealous, be proud. That's it. That's what almost all of history hinges on. Are you going to be jealous of someone who is special, or are you going to be proud to be part of the same scheme, plan, purpose?
It's a hard thing anti-Semitism, for human
to do. Yeah, but anti-Semitism will disappear because it will be replaced with pride. Those are the only options. I have a brother who is a very, very good singer. Now I have a choice. I can either be jealous and resent his talent, or I can say, "Hey, he's my brother.
But you've also got your own thing going on.
Everybody's got their own
thing. Or the potential for
the
their
potential,
own thing.
Right.
Whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I had nothing going on, I would be even more proud of him. Because that's the only thing I've got to be proud of.
No, if you had nothing going on, you may be jealous.
I may, or I may be desperate to identify.
Right.
At least I have a brother who's great,
right. Yeah.
Even if I'm not. Right?
But I think if you're not jealous, then the possibility of you having your own thing going on is more possible.
Yeah. Yeah. Being jealous just cripples you. So this is what's going to happen. When we speak with confidence, when we tell the world the truth, which they're really desperate to hear, because they know they're messed up. They really know it.
Well, that's what we were asking you. Do they know they're messed up, or they believe in what they're thinking?
The reason they are so intense and so extreme is because of the doubt. If you were really confident, you wouldn't obsess about it. So they're really desperate to find out the truth. And when we tell them the truth, despite their mistreatment of us, they will take the mosque down so that we can build the Beis HaMikdash. And that will be for them an honor.
So you're saying that we need to project more confidence and they need to be proud?
They will be.
Of us?
If we project confidence, then they will be proud.
I mean, so much of the Christian world is now saying, those who bless you will be blessed.
Right.
We're proud to be your partners in crime.
Yeah, they are saying
I mean,
that.
It's interesting because I always try to look at these ideas from a more like human internal, you know, perspective, right?
Perspective.
So say you have someone who wants to project confidence, but they are worried that projecting that confidence might make them look arrogant or might invite criticism and harsh judgment, which will bring negative energy into their life. And they worry about that and what that might cause. They also don't want to make people jealous. I mean, there's so many ways to look at it. And it's like, it's a real thing. People experience jealousy a lot, and you don't see the jealous people striving to become proud of the person that they're jealous of. But how great would it be if they can hone in on that? Like, I don't have to be jealousy is not going to bring me anything good. Yet so many of us do that. So it's like, where do we go with that?
And playing humble hasn't brought us any good either.
Right.
We've tried that for 1,000 years at least.
Playing
no,
humble.
We're not chosen. We're just
right.
like you. You
so
know?
What would you say genuine humility is?
Genuine humility means the facts are what they are.
And talk about them?
Yeah, true is true, right is right. Has nothing to do with my opinion, my feelings, my needs. True is true. We're chosen. What are we supposed to say to God? No?
It's interesting that there's so much debate in Judaism when there is really the one truth. I guess within that truth, there's a lot of disagreement.
And one good example, encouraging example. When the United States moved their embassy to Jerusalem, everyone was sure there's going to be riots in the streets, there's going to be bloodshed, there's going to be an outcry, the United Nations is going to go crazy. What happened? Nothing. Nothing. Because, come on, Jerusalem is the capital. What are you going to do? Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. When did that even become controversial? So why do you consider Jerusalem the capital of Israel? I'm not having this conversation.
So are you hopeful about it? Like I'm saying, you've put your book out, you're trying to do your part to spread the word of the truth.
Yeah.
And how do you see this happening, person by person?
Yeah, of course.
Sharing it on the podcast. I'm saying, do you see this happening, that we become a more confident people?
It will happen. If I can move it along a little bit, I'd love to. But it's going to happen.
Well,
simply
usually,
because it's true.
Right, because truth does prevail.
Yes. So people say, look, you believe that it's true. We believe that it's true when Jews talk among themselves, but nobody else is going to believe it. That is the ultimate, most dangerous damage that exile and persecution has created. You no longer believe that true is powerful? Look at what's happened to our world. Truth no longer exists. One of the predictions before the coming of Mashiach, truth will be absent. Well, I know it's true, but nobody else. Right? So true doesn't really carry its own weight. True is not powerful. True is not convincing. True is not... Oh, so what are we left with? Just tell a better lie. Whoever lies best wins. Are you really willing to lower yourself to that level where truth doesn't mean anything? The whole world has become Hollywood. Life is simply whoever tells the best lie. This is what we're at. This is what we've deteriorated to. You don't think that truth carries its own weight? You don't think when people hear the truth, they just bow and agree? Then you've given up the ship. So just keep on lying and come up with a better lie. This will bring peace? Of course not.
It's funny because truth is quite simple and people like to make things complicated. So
truth
is simple. It sounds too simple.
Truth is simple. So it's inevitable. We can't live a life of lies. We can't live Hollywood. I'm just speaking to a Christian missionary. And I said, look, I'm not interested in anything you have to say as long as you keep lying. He says, I'm lying? I said, yeah. You tell me that you know what Mashiach looks like. You have pictures of him. You have statues of him. He looks Scandinavian. He's tall, he's blonde, he's fit. That's not what Mashiach looks like. He was a Jewish guy. He was short, fat, and bald. So why do you keep lying by putting up fake pictures? People actually say, I saw him in my dream. You saw him? Tall, blonde, and Scandinavian? Stop lying.
So
your whole approach is a fake.
When you said to him, because that's engaging in a conversation that you think is ridiculous. So, but you were engaging in the conversation.
No, I was saying there's no further conversation until you stop lying.
Oh, okay, fine.
Right. I'm going to debate theology with you when you can't even be honest.
Okay. And was he enlightened?
He was resentful.
Okay.
but the point is, are we not using falsehood in every area of life, including religion?
So we need to strip off the layers.
Stop lying. Is that too difficult?
It's interesting because recently there's been like a sort of shift in our understanding of therapy, where I think her name is Abigail Schreier. She talked about how we're doing too much validating of people's inner truths, and we need to stop doing that. We need to start just like stop sending everybody to therapy. You know, this is your reality. Sometimes they just need to accept it, like unapologetically. And she had a lot of backlash, but she also has a lot of people who are, you know, hardcore followers of her views. And I just like, I'm just wondering if it, you know, what role validation and therapy plays in, you know, what we're talking about, this more shift towards like human.
There's no question that there's truth to what she's saying. We are over-medicated, no question about that, and we're over-therapized. Too much. If you're not that sick, don't take that much medicine. And if you're not that sick, stop with the therapy.
Because we're told to use the tools that are that are available to us for betterment of our lives, of our health. At the same time, we need to also accept, you know, the reality that we're in or what we've been given. So how do we balance that?
But again, the falsehood, the whole unreal, like some people are gay. Well, then everybody should be. Then everybody is. Some people need to transition. Well, then everybody should. What is the truth? You know, that's a silly example of some guy faints and they ask, anybody know CPR? And the guy says, I do. He said, if I give him CPR, I'm going to have to give everybody, and I don't have time for that. You're going to have to give everybody. This ridiculous attitude that we're all the same. We all need the same thing. No, we don't. If a guy doesn't need CPR, don't give it. So, are we afraid of the truth? For some reason? Why? When has the truth ever harmed you? Lies will always harm you. So is it difficult to go from lying to being truthful? No, it's much harder to make up lies.
It's hard. It's difficult, but it's, I think, more difficult not to. Meaning it's difficult to move closer toward your truth, because that means you'll probably be met with some
demons
pushback, which is what would happen if, let's say, Israel, for example, were to, you know, just do what needed to be done. But it's harder not to in that, look at these many, you know, years.
I'm thinking that at this point,
it's easier to,
there'll be no pushback, like with Jerusalem.
That would be interesting to witness.
Yeah. That would be great.
Well, imagine if a Jewish leader got up in the UN and said, as a member of the chosen people, I want to tell you something. Will there be pushback? I don't think so.
Right. You don't see that being some article, who does he think he is as the chosen? No, probably not. I don't know. We've never experienced it, so we don't know.
Right.
Who's going to say, no, you're not the chosen people? Who's going to say that?
Right.
Some frustrated idiot? So what? The world will not push back.
Right, with absolute confidence.
Yeah, the world with won't. Confidence.
I think that people get kind of caught in the back and forth in the game.
And trying to conform.
Right. Almost like a codependency situation.
Yeah. Or just trying to please.
In everyday life, all these rules of engagement apply to our own battles. If you're not confident about what is correct, then don't even try to be correct. You're just going to frustrate yourself. If the mitzvah is definitely right and the sin is definitely wrong, you got a chance. If you're not even sure of that, if you're not sure that every mitzvah gives God pleasure and every sin gives God agony, if you're not sure of that?
Well, those things are obvious, but then there are things, let's say we're talking about confidence. For example, if you think you've been wronged in some way, is it right and moral and some of the words that you've been using to stand up for yourself? Or is it more moral to just be quiet? Do you know what I mean? In your own life, there are some things that are questionable.
Yeah, well, that's very vague. But in marriage counseling, for example, very often you hear the complaints. And after they finish complaining about each other, I said, okay, you tell me one thing that you're doing wrong.
to the person themselves, yeah.
And you tell me one thing you're doing wrong. Let's at least get real that this is a two-sided thing. It's amazing how much that changes the whole relationship, the whole tone of somebody wronged you. Okay. Have you wronged ever wronged anybody, including this person? If you can admit that, yeah, you also wronged, all of a sudden, the whole thing becomes reasonable. The thought that I am completely innocent and this person is completely evil, there's no place to go from there. That's not... So if Israel could admit, or let's say the secular segment of Israeli population can admit that, nah, not so good to be secular. And the religious can admit we haven't behaved ourselves properly. What a giant step towards real peace. So a little bit of humility is very helpful, especially when you're indignant. Indignant is always a little over the top. I can't believe she could do such a thing. You do it all the time. What do you mean you can't believe? It's a human thing. She's the only one who ever lied. Stop it. Stop with the dramatics. Human beings lie, including you. So what are you going to do? Don't act like you're horrified. Even the horrors of October 7th. Well, this is the first time you've heard of this? In every war, people massacre babies. Don't act like...
So there's this combination that you're saying that we're going to say we're the chosen people, but then you're also saying that we should look at ourselves and that we're... You know, we are also...
Especially if you're the chosen people.
Right. So I'm saying it's to be confident and also recognize, have the humility to recognize that you're human.
Be confident not of yourself.
Be confident as a Jew.
Be confident of what you stand for.
Right.
Of the facts of life and admit that you don't always live up to it.
There's a lot of people who experience this feeling of not knowing, clearly. I mean, not knowing how to be confident. And in a relationship also, sometimes truth can be, you have to discern, but you know, there's different truths in different people. And so you can have someone say, well, if I need to ask myself, what is my role in this? What's my responsibility here? Right? For example, okay, so I'm saying that this person lies, but do I lie sometimes? Yeah. So what's my responsibility is maybe to check myself whenever I feel like I'm about to engage in a lie, for example. So the question really is like, how do you discern between like a truth and a truth that is an absolute truth, let's say for myself and in my relationships with others, versus a truth that can be, you know, like played around with a little bit, or that's not really a whole absolute truth. How do I navigate that in a relationship?
So I think it's helpful what the Rambam says. We should always consider ourselves perfectly balanced. I'm good, I'm bad. I'm truthful, I'm false. The next move I make will tilt the scale one way or the other. So instead of focusing on, so who am I really? Who am I really? You're half and half. The question is not who are you really? The question is what's your next step? That is so useful. That's so practical. And then you don't need therapy.
I think I heard this term shared by someone. It's called the life on hold syndrome. It's like, I don't know what to do in this situation. And I like that approach, sort of like, what's your next step? What's the next step?
And do you think it's good to pause before the next step? Because I'm saying, look what happened with Israel. They paused. They took a while to start moving, and that wasn't necessarily a good thing. But sometimes, you know, it is good to pause.
It's good to be thoughtful. But you should be thoughtful before the problem occurs.
Right.
Not because the problem occurred. So just very briefly, in our own battles, is there this idea of proportional response? The Baal Shem Tov said, if you are horrified by your evil inclination, by your temptations and unholy thoughts and so on, be proportional. Don't torture your body, you know, don't afflict yourself. Don't try to kill your body in order to, that's not proportionate. Why? It doesn't lead to the goal. Your reaction should be proportionate to the objective.
Hard on yourself as much as needed to get you to the place where you want to be?
Yeah. Be as tough with yourself as progress demands, not regress.
It's hard to know what that would be.
Yes, yes. But there is such a thing as proportional. Mm-hmm. That Eber said once, like the multi-stage rockets to get to the moon, once one rocket has used up its one stage of the body of the thing, once it used up its energy, don't carry an empty part of the get rid of it. Lighten the load. Mm-hmm. Don't burden yourself with moral obligation, commitment to when it's not helping you, it's dragging you down. Be proportionate. Proportionate again means keep your eye on the goal and get there as quickly and as effortlessly as possible. And what about civilians? You should kill your Yetzer Hara. But don't kill your animal soul.
Right.
Your animal soul is not a threat. It's a civilian. Doesn't know which way to go. Doesn't know up from down. Don't kill him. A civilian, you actually feed him. And make a friend out of him.
A lot of people have the goal of being happy. And it's, you know, obviously fleeting, because happiness is a byproduct, not really necessarily a goal. But then we also have, you know, now especially in Adar, an obligation to be besimcha, which can be translated as, I guess, happy or joyful. So could you make a distinction between, like, I want to be happy and I have a moral obligation to be happy?
I have one thought on that subject, because it is Adar. How do you make yourself happy? How can you be commanded to be happy? Tomorrow, you have to be happy. What do you want me to do? What do you want me to do? So you can say, you know, fake it till you make it. Okay. Not a bad idea. But is that really all there is to it? In order to be happier, you need to be more enthusiastic. And you can be enthusiastic anytime you want. It's doable. You can't make yourself happy, but you can be a little more enthusiastic.
You have to find what to be enthusiastic about.
Whatever it is you're doing. If you're doing it, do it enthusiastically. The joy will follow. So what part can you control? The enthusiasm. You're doing it.
Can you control can someone...
Maybe it's like happy as an active state versus happy as a passive state.
Right.
So enthusiastic is more active. Like you have to.
No, what someone has a job and they're not, then it's not something they love, and so they're not enthusiastic about it. It's hard. You have to. It's hard to force enthusiasm. No.
It might be hard, but
look. As long as you're doing it.
Right.
do it best.
Right. And what? That can be considered enthusiastic.
It is.
Right.
Put a little more energy. You're a teacher. Don't sound so bored. Put a little more energy into it.
Yeah.
What, you can't do that? Of course you can.
So enthusiasm leads to happiness.
Yes.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Right. And for people who say they can't, there's an analogy of someone saying they can't be happy. There's no way I could be happy. I'm feeling very low. And someone said, well, if I gave you $10 million and said, this is contingent on your being happy right now, starting now for the next 7 days, what do you think that person would do? Meaning, it's not that you can't do it. It's just that you're not doing it. So we can all do it, I hope. I mean, you're walking around.
You know, people who are in a job they don't like refuse to be enthusiastic.
Right, because they know they don't like it, and why would they want to be enthusiastic?
It's like a protest. I'm going to do it, but I'm not going to be enthusiastic because I don't like it.
Right.
As long as you're doing it, do it enthusiastic. You don't like it? Get another job. But don't do this one half-hearted. It's a terrible habit. Go through life at half mast. Do it.
If you walk around on any given day, most of what you see is people not doing that.
Right.
Everyone looks, like they're just trying to get through the day. And it's a shame.
And that even practically is not a good idea.
Right.
Whatever you're doing, stay alive. Don't die at the job. And if you really don't like the job, get a different one. But as long as you're at this job, you do the best. Because you got to live.
Enthusiasm. Yeah. You know, we sent out that we're interviewing you, and there were a few people that wrote in some questions. So can we just give you a few of them, a couple that
How
will
about
tie
one?
In? Sorry?
How about one?
Okay. Oh, boy. Which one, Ida?
I think it should relate to what we're talking about today.
Maybe we should talk about the physical body, that first question.
Okay.
Because you were just saying that the civilian is our animal soul and that we shouldn't be hard on it. We should bring out the best in it. So somebody is asking what your view is on weight loss and body image within Judaism, within Torah.
If it's an obsession, it's obviously not good. Any obsession is not good. It very quickly becomes an obsession. So better to avoid. You want to be healthy? So be healthy. Don't make a religion out of it. Don't go to heroic extremes, because you got to live your life, even if you're not perfect. Wanting to be perfect before you start living life, that's a slow suicide. So we don't need to be perfect. Not physically, not spiritually, not emotionally. You don't need to be perfect. But you need to be enthusiastic about the purpose for which you exist. As you are. You also want to improve? Fine, in your spare time. Don't obsess. And don't make it a condition. I cannot function until I lose weight. Mm-mm. You know, all sorts of people can serve God. Skinny people, fat people. There is no condition on serving God. So serve God as you are. In your spare time, you can improve.
Okay, that's a good answer.
Yeah.
That's good. Don't obsess. What should we be obsessed with?
Nothing.
Nothing.
There is no obsessing.
Because, it's interesting. Being enthusiastic about something usually leads you to be very, I don't know if the word is obsessed, but very into that thing.
Enthusiastic is a level of energy. Obsessing is an emotional addiction. A very different thing.
Right. So we shouldn't obsess over anything.
Don't be a slave to anything. Not even to your religion. It seems like a contradiction.
That's an interesting one. Yeah.
God says you have to be my servant.
Right, we are servants.
But freedom of choice. So whoa. Every servant has freedom of choice? Aren't they two opposites?
Right.
You have to serve me by your choice. Obsession means you have no choice. That's not healthy. It's not what God wants.
Obsession means you have no choice. You're choosing to be obsessed.
No.
Or you're a slave to it. You're a slave to it if you're obsessed.
Yeah.
So what would you say the difference?
It's stronger than you.
Right. Between passion and obsession. So you can be passionate about it.
Passion is your passion. Obsession, you belong to. It doesn't belong to you. You belong to it.
Right. It's very hard when you're saying like you shouldn't be obsessed, a slave to anything, and then to also have the passion and the enthusiasm. Like it's a balance. Do you know what I mean? To be
human.
Yeah, to be, you know what I'm saying? To be balanced and also be enthusiastic.
Yeah.
Because usually you gravitate to something more than something else.
By choice.
Right. But you're saying
by compulsion.
Right. So we should gravitate. We should be doing this in a healthy way. And a healthy way would be a mixture of everything.
So the Gemara puts it this way. A person shouldn't say, I can't sin. A person should say, I could sin, but my Father in heaven doesn't like it.
Mm-hmm. And how does that relate to what we were just saying?
Obsession means I can't sin. I can't do this.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I can sin.
I could, but I'm choosing not to.
And I can be good at it too. But I choose not to because my Father in heaven is a little more important than my little pleasures. So yeah, obsession means I have no choice.
I think
like addiction.
Yeah.
Addiction, yeah.
Even if someone says like I can't do this, let's say somebody wants to address something important, but they feel like they can't. Like I used to feel like I can't be confrontational. I can't. But that's not true. I can. I just chose not to because of whatever the cost was. Do you know what I mean? It's like it's whether it had a hold on me or I actually was, you know, making the call.
And when you're obsessed with something, whether it's a thought or something you're involved in, you're trapped in it, and then you're not really allowing yourself choice.
So it's not you doing it.
Right. I'm saying when you wrote your book, there's probably a difference between being involved in something very deeply or being obsessed with it. It can lead to obsession.
And there are people who are more prone to it.
Right.
You know, they live on a very intense energy level.
Yeah.
And everything has to be over the top or it's not interesting at all.
Right. So what does that person do?
Well, you got to
hone it in.
Cool it.
Yeah.
Because the Friedmans are cool, you know, so it's easier.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess everyone has different things they've got to work on.
You have to be passionate, but it's not the same as obsessed.
Right.
Right. Okay.
So on that note,
we can wrap up with Adam and Eve if you want.
Okay, so we're going to wrap up. Well, I wanted to ask you like either if you want to share the best advice you feel you've given or the best advice you've received.
Or both.
Well, let's put it this way. The best advice I have given is the advice that I received.
Which was?
If I make it up, it's not the best advice. In other words, I had some very, very great teachers. Unbelievable. We were very, very fortunate. And I think there are some really great teachers today too. All is not lost.
It's good to know.
It's good to know. And sharing the wisdom that was always wise is the wise way to go.
It's the truth.
Stop looking for gimmicks or tricks or new inventions or true means. It always was and it always will be. Well, how much do we know that is always and forever? Only the Torah.
So that, yeah, and what would be a piece of advice that you received that stands out to you from the Rebbe or from one of your teachers?
It's not about me. That is so important. My life is not about me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tells you everything.
Yeah.
Right. And so when we say we are the chosen people, that's not about me. You're saying it's about we.
We are chosen, not we choose. So who is it about?
It's about Hashem.
It's about the chooser. Not about me. I'm the result of his choice.
Right, so I think that's how it would be a good way to share it with humility, knowing that we are chosen. It's not about me. It's about that Hashem chose us.
Yes. You don't say no to him, you know, if he chose, what are you going to do?
So we always end with a favorite quote. Is there something that stands maybe to bring together to win a war? Is this
a quote or a verse even?
Or a verse within your book or something that you want to share, or a parting message?
My favorite quote?
Yeah.
If you raise your children, you can spoil your grandchildren. If you spoil your children, you're going to have to raise your grandchildren, and you're too old for that.
Oh, wow.
Never heard that one. That's great.
That's great.
Oh, is that true?
Could you share a tip for raising good children? Hmm? Just one. Could you share a tip for how to raise good children?
That's a big subject. That's the first thing is you educate your children to know it's not about me. That is so healthy. That is so strong. It's so liberating. It's so sane. Because if it is about me, I'm crazy.
Yeah, no, it is a good thing to teach children. But yet, I think it was, you know, isn't being a child a time to be selfish?
That doesn't mean you should encourage it.
Right.
That's naturally the case. He has not outgrown the pettiness or the selfishness of childhood. But you're educating him to move on, not stay there.
Yeah, they can see it by example.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, that's a great quote. And that would lead to a generation of selfless, confident, healthy people. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. May we win the war.
All of them.